Okay, today is September 20th, 2021. This is an oral history interview with George Shaw. We are conducting this interview virtually over the phone. We have two interviewers and one narrator. I am Patience Stewart. I'm a historian and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Kevin, we'll go to you next.
And this is Kevin Taylor, calling from Greenville, South Carolina. I am a health physicist and nuclear engineer.
And George?
And I am George Shaw, and I am a resident of Kenai, Alaska.
Great.
And former operator and shift supervisor at the SM1A.
Great, thank you. We're really happy that you're taking some time to talk with us today. And would your full name, as you'd like it documented for the interview, be George Shaw?
Yes.
Okay. And would you prefer to be called George or Mr. Shaw during our conversation today?
Oh, George is good enough.
Okay, great. And tell us, George, what was the time frame that you worked at SM1A?
They sent me to the nuclear power school in August of 1962. I was back at Fort Greely in December of 1963, and I worked there until August of 1968.
Great. And how did you end up in the training program? How did you end up there?
That goes back a few years earlier. The Army post and port at Whittier, Alaska, was being closed as a military post. I was a civilian employee there in the Marine engineer on tugs and other floating equipment. And I have a chief engineer's license for motor vessels. So when the list of eligible employees went around different places in Alaska, I got offered jobs in the power plants at several posts. I knew the plant superintendent at Fort Greely, and before Whittier closed, I made a fast trip up the highway to Greely and talked to my friend, and he told me, George, there's this nuclear plant being built. They're going to send people to school. And he thought I should go. He said, you can go. You can do that. So he put in for me to be transferred to Fort Greely as a power plant operator, which I did in June of 1962. The SM1A, I don't believe it had gone critical yet. It was still in the last stages of construction. I got there in June of 1960 is when I went up to Fort Greely. Yes. So I got there and it was still under construction. And I got promoted the next year to maintenance foreman at the Fort Greely Conventional Power Plant. And I was one of the people put down as possible school going, but nobody could tell us when we would go to the school. So I had met my wife-to-be in 1960, and we were planning a wedding. Come the summer of 1962, I said, well, I'm going to take my vacation and get married in June, July, and I'll be back about the 1st of August of 1962. Went out, got married, came back up the Alaska Highway, got to Fort Greely about the 1st of August 1962, and they said, George, you're going to school in 30 days. So it was a mad scramble to store things and down the Alaska Highway again to Virginia. And the school started in September of 1963 and lasted till, I believe, early November, or started in September of 1962 and lasted until early November of 1963. And I was back in Fort Greely by around the 1st of December of 63 and to work as an operator in the nuclear power plant.
And were you joined by, I think when we spoke before, you had said that there were a handful of you that went from Alaska?
There were four of us who went with the first group, and another four went with the second group, which was 6 months later, maybe. And I am not certain whether there was a third group of civilians, because what happened after they started talking about being a civilian plant, quite a few of the military people who were close to retirement would take their retirement and go to work there. So they were converting to a civilian cadre. So because of the military being moved in and out on 2 year, 3 year rotations.
Do you remember much about the training?
Pardon?
Do you recall much of the training program in Virginia?
Well, the first 4 months was academic. Math and science, nuclear physics, narrowly pointed toward the operation of a nuclear power plant. I would have been 34, and I thought, boy, these young kids are going to ace me out, but it turned out that experience did help me. But like I say, it was narrowly pointed toward nuclear plant operation. The second 4 months was either in the little SM-1 nuclear plant at Fort Belvoir or on the simulator. And this ran us through everything and anything you could think about. There again, my experience helped me out a lot in the plant itself. Nothing was strange to me except the reactor operation. The third 4 months section, I was supposed to go either mechanical or electrical, but because I had a lot of experience, I asked to have the the health physics and radiation and water chemistry sections instead, and they did change me to that. So I had a very well-rounded one-year school there, I'll tell you.
Sounds like it. Kevin, do you have any questions about the training?
Just one. We learned that many of the enlisted operators, you know, certainly had to qualify from had to rank really high in their testing, you know, to be invited to the program or to qualify for the program. Did you have to take the same types of qualification tests to be entered into the program?
No. Mine was strictly experience. Most of my engine room seagoing time, of course, was good qualification. No. And I don't recall that anybody else spoke of that either. About half the civilians, as I recall, that went to the school had previous power plant or at least utility plant experience in Alaska and worked for Yukon Command or Alaska Command at one of the big coal-fired power plants on the various posts up here.
After your training, George, and you arrived back in Alaska and, you know, at Greeley, was there additional training or did you feel ready to go?
I felt I was ready for the operator's job, yes. That was the job description, nuclear power plant operator, and I'm not sure whether that job description or the shift supervisor's one was the one that corresponded to an AEC reactor operator. But I believe it corresponded to the old Atomic Energy Commission reactor operator position.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to describe what the day-to-day of the position was like?
If you were the control room operator, you had the reactor controls right in front of you at a desk set up, and a lot of the other controls on panels, the electrical for the generator, and so on around the room. If you were the outside operator, and they tried to run the plant with a two-man shift, the outside operator watched all the equipment on the turbine floor and on the lower deck where the feed water pumps and all of the auxiliary machinery was.
Did you do both?
Yes, of course, yes. Mm-hmm. We switched around back and forth on those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not do continuous. At times, we would shift off of that kind of work and be helping in the maintenance. They rotated people around quite rapidly, I thought, to get a more rounded experience.
Did you have a favorite task or something that was particularly interesting to you?
I thought it was very interesting, yes. I enjoyed working there.
And you said that when you first arrived, the reactor had not gone critical yet. Do you have...
Yes, sometime when I first went to Fort Greely working in the conventional plant, I believe the reactor went critical in May of 1962, and I went out to school in August.
Okay.
Somewhere I should have a note about that, but I couldn't find it.
Sure.
I think that was really what they were waiting for before they sent civilians to school, was to have the plant up and running.
When you were there, did you live on base? Did civilians and active duty both live on base, or did you live elsewhere?
I lived at that time after I got married, it was off base. When I first went there, they had bachelor civilian quarters on base.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in them in 60 to 62.
Okay. Oh, so you were there when it went. Do you have memories of when it first went critical?
No, just except that they went critical. Let's see. By that time, we were connected to the local utility, Golden Valley Electric, which stretched from Fairbanks to Nenana and down to Big Delta. So being connected to that utility, when they brought the reactor up and started generating electricity, we had to back offload on our generators. And just because of the length of the transmission lines, we, on our end, held up the power factor. So we had to do adjustments in the conventional plant when the reactor came up and started making electricity.
Kevin, do you have any more questions? Do you have any questions to follow up about that?
Yeah. The And perhaps you mentioned this earlier, but so you were in Alaska when you heard about the program. You live in Alaska now. Are you a native Alaskan? Have you lived there all your life? What got you in Alaska the first time?
What got me here the first time was I was born in Juneau. And yes, my family has been in Alaska. It started out in Juneau for, 120 years or a little more.
Wow. Wow. So not only are you a piece of the nuclear history of Alaska, you're a piece of the history of Alaska.
Well, yes, in some ways, yeah.
So you mentioned, George, that you were pulling out a bunch of old materials from your time there. Do you want to tell us about some of them?
Well, a lot of it is just the general civil service paperwork, the appointment, promotion, transfer type papers. I have the two different copies of the SM1A brochure. I have another one entitled Five on the Line, which details all five of the nuclear power plants that were running and the one that they had under consideration, the floating plant that never got built. Certificates and a few newspaper clippings, one or two from the Fairbanks newspaper about the people going to school, and the certificates from the school and stuff like that.
Do you have any photographs from your time there?
I thought I did, and I can't find them. I thought I had some from the control room.
Sure.
And I couldn't find them, and it could be in a stack of old 35-millimeter slides, which I didn't go through, really, or at least didn't see them there.
Sure.
The others I have are just the general publicity-type photos that the Army might have taken. I have a couple of 8x10s of the plant itself from the outside, which shows the conventional plant and a few other things.
I
wish I had thought of this earlier, but we should have tried to set up a Zoom call. My children got me into that, and we do one every Sunday afternoon where you're talking to everybody and you can show people things.
Sure. Well, I would love to do that with you, and we should. It doesn't work so well for the recording quality, so that's why we've done
right.
It on the phone, but there's no reason. I'd love to see those photos, and maybe we could do that after this call or another time. We can arrange a Zoom.
I think that's a great idea, because sounds like he may have some things that aren't in the Corps of Engineers archives already that might be certainly, you know, get copies of, whether they're articles or photographs or something. I'm sure they would love to have copies of that if there are things that they don't already have.
I've
got a pretty good idea of what we have already. So.
Sure. Yeah. And
if you give me a few days, I will go through the slides again and see if there's anything particular in there.
Okay, great. Thank you for taking the time to do that. I'll set something up for us for later this week.
Just a little aside, I did personally bring the reactor up twice. After our refueling in 67, I think I did it, because that one stuck in my mind. They had made a mistake on the placing of the reactor instrumentation. It was too high in the tubes above or around the core. And we had a a real conundrum there for a while.
Could you tell us more about that, about how they had to connect?
Yes. Yep. When you bring a pressurized water reactor, the minute you start generating heat, you get a bump. But that bump will also tamp the reactor down a bit because it's temperature dependent. And that's what happened. We were bringing the reactor up, and at the point we expected to see this little bump, it didn't happen. And so it came up a little bit more and didn't happen. And then we dropped the control rods back down, and everybody's pondering what the heck's going on. And I started rolling out the one script chart, and there I called the plant superintendent, the warrant officer. I called him over and I said, look at that. And at the very bottom of the script chart was two little squiggles of ink. And so, that looks like it. And then they did some recalculations and decided we had to go back in, pull it and measure where the neutron instruments were and reset them. That one was interesting.
Yeah. How did you go in? I mean, did you have tools that went in, or did somebody actually tell me a little bit more about that?
I did not go in and do any of that kind of work. They had to, of course, drain the entry tube into the vapor container and go in and lift the head on the reactor to reset the instruments. I was in there when we refueled, and I'm one of those people who have seen the blue radiation from the spent fuel tank through 20 feet of water, of course. But, yes. Yeah, you're bringing back memories.
Well, good memories, I hope. Some of them, at least.
Yes, generally, yeah. The very last year there was not so good, and it was, I don't know, just the idea of, because there was a core in the reactor, a qualified operator had to be in that control room all the time. And you're staring at instruments that never move, and nobody knows what they're going to do. And the job came up here in Kenai, and I resigned in 68, came down to a petrochemical plant and worked for Union Oil for 20 years.
Well, did your experience at within the nuclear program with the Army, you think it provided you with additional benefits throughout your career, or was it it was just kind of stop on the road?
I got hired as an operator and moved right up to a lead man and then a shift supervisor within 4 years, I think it was. I ended up a day supervisor, and my area of the plants was all of the auxiliary. We generated our own electricity, had our own water wells. Of course, for 1,500-pound steam, you have to have high-purity water, so all that kind of work fell on my shoulders after we doubled the size of the plant here. So, yes, I would say it definitely helped me.
Absolutely.
What about your thoughts before you started working on nuclear power and after you started working on nuclear power, and thoughts of your family and those others around you? And did they worry about you working in nuclear at the time, or were they just, at that time, it's still pretty early?
At that time in the 60s, nobody had a lot of worries about the nuclear power plants. that was long before, what was the one in Pennsylvania, Nine Mile Island or whatever, or Fukushima for that matter. There were concerns of people downstream north to northwest of the plant, off the reservation there at Fort Greeley, about contaminated water. But I don't think anything was ever proven about that. The contaminated water had to be held through the winter times because of freeze-ups, and then diluted and pumped into Jarvis Creek. In fact, from the original design of the plant to what was actually put in, they had three times as much capacity for contaminated water.
Hmm. Yeah. Where was the water stored during winter?
North of the plant building, underground, concrete containment area, and I couldn't tell you the size of the tanks, but from just guess, I would say they might have been 10,000 gallons each, but that's just a rough guess.
Okay. Now, you...
they would still be there, of course.
Now, you were there for quite a long time, and from what we've heard, the enlisted men who were operators were there on shorter terms, you know, 2 years or less. And so do you feel like you saw a fair amount of comings and goings of crew?
Yes, we had, the crews were pretty tight-knit, and we got to know everybody. We would socialize together a couple of times a year. Yeah, I can remember quite a few, holiday-type parties and things like that. And then, like I think I said, a lot of the people in the program who had been in from the beginning and had 20 years in the Army would retire and go to work up there.
Do you remember anyone in particular from your time there that you worked with?
Gordy Stola, O'Brien, Paul Miller. I'm thinking Valenzuela, but I might have that name wrong. He was an instructor at the school when I went through and came up there later. I'd have to go back and look at some other stuff I have and see if I could figure out anybody else.
Sure.
You mentioned somebody in this area, Soldotna, as having worked there.
I did. David Appleby.
You know, I don't recall that name, so he could have came up there after I
later
went.
I think that's the case. He was there more into the 70s, I believe.
Yeah.
We haven't interviewed him yet, but I've had just a little bit of contact with him. And I can put the two of you in contact. So do you remain in touch with anyone from that time?
Not anymore. I did see one of them, the one I'm not sure the name, Valenzuela. He happened to live in the California area, close to one of the Union Oil plants, and supervisory people for big companies like that get sent to other of their plants for strike training when they're doing their union negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the California refinery at San Francisco Bay and the carbon plant they had there at different times, and he lived somewhere in that area. I think all we got together was a telephone conversation, but the others, I've couple of them used to come down here to Kenai for bowling tournament deals, Miller and O'Neill or McNeil. But no, nobody else from up there actually came and worked where I did.
I see. Do you have any other memories from being on the job that you would like to share? Any days where things didn't go as expected?
No, strange as it may sound, you got used to having the plant scram on you and shut itself down automatically. And I think that was because of the training in Virginia, especially on the simulator, where the instructor could put a problem in and hope you could figure out how to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
But people say, oh, they scrammed the reactor. Wow, what'd that do? Nothing. It just shut down.
And you'd have to restart it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, if the reactor went absolutely cold, everything cooled down to ambient, it was quite a long process. There was something with heating up the metal in the reactor systems. I'm trying to think of this complicated name. Nil ductility transition temperature. You had to heat the reactor metal or piping metal before you raise the pressure. So the pumps, the primary coolant pumps, put heat into the system. And I believe it was something like 8 hours from a cold start before you started raising pressure by bringing the reactor up.
And how often would you have to do that, or how often would the reactor scram?
I could not recall. I couldn't tell you. Being on shift for a lot of that, you don't get all of the ups and downs. If the reactor scrammed for a problem that was easily solved and nothing had cooled off, you could bring it back pretty fast.
I see.
And the way the reactor controls were built, if anything happened, the control rods dropped. Gravity put them down along with the drive of the rods. So,
would it surprise you that if I told you that today the diesel steam plant and backup electric generator still use the switch gear from the original SM1A plant?
The backup generator? We had an arrangement where we could use steam from the plant boilers to run the generator at a reduced load. Are they using that?
Well, they have a steam plant there. And but they get electricity off the grid, and then they have backup electric generators at steam plant that are diesel fired.
We had three 1,000 kW diesel electric generators and three boilers in the original plant. Oh yes, I heard that they had put a fourth diesel generator in. So that might be what they use the controls, the electrical switch gear for.
But they still use some of the original switch gear.
Yeah. Well, that was the original switch gear was the standard GE electrical switch gear. We had the same thing here in Kenai. Yeah. There was nothing special about the electrical end, the steam turbine generator, or the switch gear.
Do you recall any incidents that made you think, maybe I'm not in the right place right now? Any accidents or any other kind of just, you know, strange incidences? I mean, you mentioned one about the...
about that startup that we had everybody scrambling to figure out what happened. And it was a misplaced indicators of radiation or neutron transmitters, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a few people... go ahead.
The steam generator leak, of course, was putting contaminated steam out into the post heating system, and especially to the post laundry. Because the contaminated steam could leave deposits in steam traps. And I don't think it ever got to the point where it was dangerous for the people working, but it could build up over time. And like I say, when I left, they had not made any decision on repairing that steam generator. I heard later that there was an extra steam generator at Fort Belvoir that they brought up and modified and put in. And at that point, the Army was giving up on the nuclear power plant ideal. And they used the SM-1A to use up all of the cores that had been built for the various nuclear plants.
We heard that too.
That is true. They did replace the steam generator in, I believe, 68.
So. No, it was still not there in August of 68.
Okay.
That's when I resigned, and I didn't hear about anything happening up there about that until a year or two later. And it would have taken them maybe, I don't know, 6 months or whatever to do the changeover, I believe.
Yeah, maybe it might have been during 69 and 70 that they replaced that, and they operated till 72.
73?
72. They shut down in March 72. Yep.
Okay. See, I was hearing about all this stuff 6 months to a year after it would happen. There wasn't much publicity about it. No, sitting there, like I said, in a cold iron plant wasn't very good. When I went up for a job interview in Fairbanks with Union Oil, four of us from the plant went up. And I know one other person was offered a job but didn't take it. I think he had a year or two before his 20-year military retirement, and he didn't want to give that up, and he never followed through after that.
But you were all interested in a change at that time?
Pardon?
You were all interested in a change that the four of you went up to interview?
Yes. It didn't look like they were going to do any repairs. And so I don't know how many people might have applied. The four of us were asked to come up to Fairbanks and take a job interview.
Mm-hmm. So for you, it was more of the job itself that kind of that led you out. We've heard others. We spoke to one gentleman who it was the fact of being up there in Alaska, and he was single at the time and didn't have, you know, all the other servicemen were married, and there wasn't much to offer him. And then we spoke with one gentleman who just really loved the hunting and the fishing and everything, and he seemed to really enjoy his time up there. But I guess you being from Alaska, you were familiar with, you knew what you were getting into from an environment standpoint, but it was just the work got a little monotonous for you, huh?
Well, yes, especially with the shutdown, and the wife was tired of 40 degrees below zero winters. I knew that after about two winters up there. Well, We had been down on the Kenai one summer or fall on a trip, and she jokingly said as we were leaving Kenai that, George, if somebody builds a power plant down here, why don't you transfer? And so 2 years or so later, when we were sitting there doing nothing and the jobs were coming up, I said, well, you want to transfer to Kenai, I'll put in.
Sure.
There you go.
Did you have kids while you were at Greeley as well?
Yes.
Yep.
We had one child in Virginia when I was in school. Barry was born there. Two were born in Fairbanks, John and Bob. And our next daughter, Kathy, was born in Kenai. Two of them in Kenai. Yeah.
Do they have any young memories, or do you have any memories of them, you know, being little up there?
No, we lived off post, actually about 15 miles from Fort Greeley up toward Fairbanks, and the wife and I, like I say, would socialize with the group on post sometimes, but other than that, not that much contact with the post.
Sure. We've had a couple of people mention that they escorted fuel during the refueling. Is that something that you ever participated in?
Escorted?
Yes, where they would...
Oh, okay, yes. Fuel. Mm-hmm. They had casks to put the new fuel to bring the new... Well, they had empty casks and full casks. The new fuel would come up in these casks. The old fuel would come out and go into a cask, and all of that transfer was under a 20-foot of water shielding. And then the cask had to go back by truck to Fairbanks and by rail to Anchorage or Whittier, one or the other, and then be shipped. Yes, people had to escort the fuel casks. But I never did that. We only did the one refueling when I was there, and there must have been people came up from Virginia with the new fuel and went back with the old fuel at that time. But I don't recall anybody from the plant doing it. That might have been how some of the people got up there and decided they might have wanted to transfer too.
Sure. Right. Let's see, are there any other memories you'd like to share with us?
Not right now.
Well, we really appreciate that you've taken the time to do this and talk through your time up there, your experiences, and great contribution that you've made to the program, and the Army Corps of Engineers will appreciate this interview.
Well, that's good. I'm glad I can remember some of the things. If you want to do a good Zoom conference, give me a couple of days to dig through the slides. That has to be where the pictures I'm thinking of are. And then we can set up a time and do that.
Okay, sounds good. Why don't we be in touch? Let's get in touch in the next couple of days.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Kevin, do you have anything else?
I do not. I appreciate the time and the information. It's very helpful.
We definitely do. Okay, well, George, do you have anything else to say?
Nope.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, I'll go ahead and conclude the interview and turn off the recording.